Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
Well, good morning. It's great to be with you here today at the start of this new year. And I'm especially excited to be sharing with you as we start looking at the book of Jonah. I shared this morning with the few and the faithful who made it here to 8 a.m. That I have a fond spot in my heart for Jonah because when I was learning Hebrew at Ridley, one of the things we did was translate the whole of Jonah verse by verse. And it's a very sad thing to confess to you that the only thing I can remember easily of my Hebrew is the first verse of Jonah. I can still rattle it off from the top of my head. Ask me to translate any other Hebrew passage and I'll be stuck, but that verse I know. And so it's particularly exciting to be sharing with you this morning as we start looking at the start of Jonah. As Rod said, we've got a video that might appeal to the kids. I had another one here at the start, which I've had to take out because there are some small kids here, and I thought if any of the parents are hoping to take their kids to the beach, it wouldn't be an appropriate clip. Comes from the movie that starts with those two famous notes, that do-do, do-do. Everybody's laughing. We all know it, don't we? We just hear those two little notes and instantly we know what movie it's from and we know what the main character of that movie is, that big shark, that massive fish that's the main character of that movie, Jaws. I see a few kids even trembling and shaking. It can be a bit scary, and I had the clip. It was that famous scene when the protagonists in the film first encounter the shark. They realize just how big it is. And Roy Schneider utters that famous line, "You're going to need a bigger boat." Well, much the same thing happens to us when we hear the name Jonah. The second we hear it, we put it together with the story of another big fish. We instantly put our minds to Jonah and the whale. It's an instant connection for us, and I guess it's an obvious one. It's the way we learn this story when we're in Sunday school or those easy Bible stories. This is the way we learn about Jonah. It's Jonah and the whale. I had to wrestle Micah and Joshua to get their Bible off them to get these pictures in. They were very kind to let me use them. But as we're going to see today, and as we're going to see over the next few weeks, there's something even bigger than the big fish here. There's something much bigger lurking in the story of Jonah just below the surface there. It's definitely there in chapter 1 and it's there throughout the whole book, and it's something we're going to be looking at over the coming weeks. So this morning as we begin, as we set out on the trail with Jonah looking at chapter 1, I hope you'll look with fresh eyes. Try, if you can, to ignore the big fish that we all know is lurking there at the end of the chapter and see if you can spot what it is that's even bigger than that big fish. Well, the story of Jonah actually begins back in the book of 2 Kings, chapter 14. There's a handful of verses, and this is actually where we're first introduced to Jonah, and we learn quite a bit about him in those short few verses. We learn he comes from the small town of Gath Hepher, which is this little tiny dot. I had to highlight it a bit there, just there in northern Israel. Doesn't appear on many maps. I had to spend a long time on Google just to find one that showed it. A small, tiny little town in northern Israel, about 5 kilometres north of Nazareth, a town we all know. But Gath Hepher, where Jonah was from, a small, nowhere little place. What's important about it, though, is it's in the kingdom of northern Israel, and we learn from 2 Kings that Jonah lived in the time of King Jeroboam. But unfortunately, King Jeroboam was, like so many of his forefathers, an evil man. We read he did evil in the sight of the Lord. This was a terrible time for the nation of Israel. And yet God still had grace upon his people. God was not ignorant of how bitterly they were suffering. God heard their cries. God saw their distress. God saw that there was no one else to help them. And so God, in his grace, remembered his promises to be with Israel, His promise is not to blot out their name, not to allow them to be wiped out. And so God, in his grace, raised up the prophet Jonah. It's the third thing we learn about this man. He was a prophet. And he was a prophet with a message of grace for God's people. He reminded them that God was with them, that he loved them. And through Jonah then, as he preached this message of grace to the people, God used King Jeroboam to shore up, to firm up the boundaries of Israel. We can imagine then that Jonah was a pretty popular guy. It would be a pretty sweet job in the midst of a hard, troubling time to come in and bring a message of grace, to bring good news, a reminder that God is with you, bringing this message of God's grace to his people, being the prophet who spoke to the king who guided him in restoring the nation's boundaries. Those physical markers which helped separate them from larger nations which surrounded them. I've been reminded this week of just how important those boundary markers and boundary lines are and how much they still play a part in our lives today. I was reminded of this on Friday when one of our new next-door neighbours got out to mow his lawn and mowed the nature strip in front of his house. And you could tell he knew exactly where the boundary lay, because dead in line with his fence across the nature strip, that was exactly where he mowed. Even though it was only a little short distance from the edge of his fence to the edge of our driveway, he knew where the boundary was and he mowed no further. It was very clear, this is mine, this is yours. I'm not going to cross that line. It's a stark contrast to our neighbour who's on the other side of us. We met him just after we moved into our new house, and he told us he was the first resident on the street, the first person to build there when there were no other houses around, and I guess this is what gave him that sense of entitlement to cross boundaries. Because when this neighbour goes out to mow his lawn and mows that little bit of the nature strip, he doesn't do just his little bit. He goes halfway down the street and halfway up the street mowing people's nature strips. And doesn't just do it on his side of the street. He goes and mows on the other side of the street as well. He's a man who knows very well where the boundaries are, but doesn't hesitate to cross them. In his desire to be a good neighbour, to show grace to people, he ignores the boundary lines. I guess he goes even further than that, actually. Not only does he mow people's nature strips, every week he enters into people's properties to put their bins out for them. About six houses on either side, he runs out and puts the bins out every week. He was telling us he knows that the person across the road, well, they've only just moved to Australia, and that other couple down there, well, they work a lot, they're out all the time, and these people here, they've just had kids, and we're very grateful to him for putting our bins out too, particularly earlier this week when I leapt out of the shower because I heard the garbage truck and went, oh no, I'm in my towel, I'm going to have to run out and put the bins out. And Sarah said, it's okay, John's already taken care of it. He's a man who shows great grace to his neighbours in ignoring the boundary lines. And this is exactly what we're going to see God doing in the book of Jonah. While God has been gracious to his people in firming up the border of their land, he's about to ignore those boundaries in order to be even more gracious. And so as we turn to the book of Jonah, we read in those first few verses that the word of the Lord came to the prophet saying, "Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it, because its wickedness has come up before me." Well, in the original Hebrew, one of the few things I can remember, is that this initial go that we have translated here is actually a double command in the Hebrew. It's literally, get up and go. It's strong, it's forceful. There's a real sense of urgency to God's words here. This is a message that God really wants Jonah to deliver. And fair enough, we might think, until we read on past that and see where Jonah is meant to go to. Not to King Jeroboam, as he'd done before, not even to the people of Israel. Instead, Jonah's commanded to do what almost no other prophet has had to do, and that's to go and preach to the Gentiles. And not just to any Gentile nation, but to Israel's enemies, the Assyrians. And not just anywhere in Assyria. Jonah's got to go and preach in Nineveh, one of Assyria's capital cities. You've got to understand just how bad the Ninevites were. We're very fortunate this morning. We have a very authentic historical documentary clip just to show us just how bad these Ninevites really were.
That Nineveh wasn't in Israel at all. It was the capital of Assyria, and it was the biggest, meanest city around. Now, the people of Nineveh were particularly mean to Jonah's people, the Israelites. They lied, they stole, but worst of all, they slapped people with fishes. They even slapped each other with fishes. They didn't know the difference between right and wrong. The Ninevites were so mean, in fact, that most Israelites, including Jonah, wished God would just wipe Nineveh off the face of the earth.
Well, for any parents here, if your kids haven't already seen it, I highly recommend the VeggieTales edition or version of the Jonah story, which where this came from. And it's remarkably accurate, apart from maybe the slapping of fish bits that they seem to think was the worst thing that anybody could do. The Ninevites really were terrible people. We read in the later prophet Nahum just how bad they were. Nahum paints this picture of the Ninevites being evil, vicious, violent, ruthless people on the battlefield. And back home in their home city, they were no better. There was murder on the streets. There was all kinds of debauchery and prostitution rampant. These were wicked people. And so it's no surprise that their evil deeds have risen before God as some kind of unholy stench. Indeed, one contemporary Jewish writer describes Nineveh as the Ninevites as the Nazi stormtroopers of the ancient world. And he goes on to say that for Jonah then, Nineveh was no ordinary city. It was a city that carried doom-laden, tragic memories. It was, in short, evil incarnate. For Jonah to go to Nineveh flies in the face of everything he's done. Up until now, his message has been a message of grace to God's people. And now he has to go to Nineveh, their enemies. At best, he's going there to proclaim a message of judgment. And I guess he could rightly expect that the Ninevites might reward him by killing the messenger. At worst, though, there's that little possibility that God is sending him to Nineveh for another reason. To warn the Ninevites of what lies ahead. To warn them of the danger they're in if they continue on in their wicked lives. For all, if the Ninevites know that God is about to judge them for how they've been living, what if hearing this message, they change their ways? What if on hearing Jonah's message, the Ninevites repent? Could it be that God wants to show grace to the Ninevites? This is too much for Jonah. The mere possibility is too much for him to bear. And so having been told to get up and go, he does just that. He gets up and he goes, but in the opposite direction. Instead of heading north from his hometown of Gath-hepher and making the long trek up overland to Nineveh, we read that Jonah immediately gets up and he goes down to the city of Joppa, that great port city in Israel. And that's not the extent of how far he's willing to go. For we read that he goes to Joppa in search of a ship to take him all the way to Tarshish, somewhere over here at the other end of the Mediterranean. For Jonah, in his day, Tarshish represents the ends of the earth. This is as far away as he could expect to get from Nineveh. It's as if Jonah is saying, "All right, God, if you want to send someone to the Ninevites, fine, no worries. But it's just not going to be me. I've got this pressing engagement somewhere, yes, over there in Tarshish. You're just going to have to find someone else, God. I can't go." With this plan in motion, as we read, Jonah heads down to Joppa. He finds his boat, willing to go to Tarshish. He pays his ticket, hands over his fare, and he climbs on board. And there he continues to go down, for we read he climbs down into the very depths, into the hold, into the bottom of the ship. And there he promptly falls asleep. It's no surprise, really. I guess if you've been running away from God, if you've been on the road looking to get away from him, finally there in the middle of the, in the bottom of the ship, sailing out of port, you'd think, at last, I'm free. God can't get to me here. At long last, I can get some rest. And Jonah closes his eyes. But it's not long when all of a sudden he's woken up and he hears those words ringing out again. Get up, call out. The same kinds of words we heard at the start of Jonah. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm a little bit groggy in the morning, still trying to, those first few moments, trying to decide what's real and what's not. Often, as I did this morning at 5:30, lay there going, is that really a baby crying, or please, please, can I just be imagining it? And you can imagine Jonah might have been thinking the same thing. So he's starting to wake up going, what is this? What is this some kind of nightmare? Is this God calling out to me again? How can he do that? I'm on a boat heading away. But this time it's just the captain of the ship he's on warning him of a bringing message of a storm, not another divine message. Of course, that's at least what they thought. We know the truth, though. Verse 4 tells us that it's God, that the storm indeed was a message from God. It's God who sent the wind, which was now tossing the ship back and forth. It was God who raised up that terrible storm that was raging around them, that was causing not just the sailors, but the ship itself to shake and to tremble. We read that the crew had already taken drastic steps to try and weather the storm. They'd already gone to the extreme measures of throwing all the cargo overboard. We know that this is just how worried they must have been, for to lose the cargo means losing any hope of making any profit on this voyage. Losing the cargo meant losing their profits, although they didn't know there was still one prophet waiting below decks. And we also read that along with this desperate measure, as we all often do in the face of great adversity or trial in very difficult circumstances, the sailors tried that last desperate measure of calling out to their gods. But this, we read, did nothing at all, and it's no surprise. For it's only the one true God, the one true God who raised up the storm, who would be able to still it. So for all their crying out to their idols, nothing happens. And the captain of the ship entreats Jonah. He says to him, get up, call out to your God, and maybe he'll show favour to us. Know that if Jonah was to do this, it might very well happen. But Jonah remains silent. It's as if he's still trying to run away from God, not willing to even come to him and ask for his help. And so in a last act of desperation, the sailors decide to cast lots to see who it is, who's responsible for the calamity they're in. And the lot falls on Jonah. And imagine, he must have been going, how did this happen? How did this bad luck, of all the things to do, to cast lots, and here it is, it's falling on me. Great, now I've got to fess up. And he does that, but only after they bombard him with all those questions. Who are you? Where are you from? What do you do? Why are the gods so angry at us? What have you done to offend them? It's only now that Jonah spills the beans. He answers, I am a Hebrew and I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. It's a funny kind of confession. Jonah says he fears the Lord, he worships God, but here he is, heading in the opposite direction from where God wants him to go. It's a funny kind of fear, a funny kind of worship to be involved in. Not surprisingly, on hearing Jonah's confession, the sailors themselves get a little fearful. Once they realize who Jonah is and what he's done, once they realize that they've been helping him run away from God, they begin to fear. They have, be filled with fear. And meanwhile, while they've been going through this process of discovery, of finding out who the real culprit is, things have only been getting worse for them as well. For we read the storm has been getting rougher and rougher. And in the end, Jonah tells them that the only way it's going to end, the only way the storm will cease, is if they throw him overboard along with the cargo. To their credit, the sailors don't just pick up Jonah at that. I might have not even waited for him to finish speaking before I was hurling him over the edge of the ship. The sailors at least try. They do their best to row ashore. They grab the oars and bend their backs and strain with all their might. Some of you might know I grew up in Queensland, and so I still struggle to get my head around the AFL and to... I still have to really push myself to sit down and watch a game of what you call footy. But if you put a game of Origin on the telly, I'd be sitting down watching it without hesitation. And one of the things I love about Union, as opposed to League, which you might not quite understand the difference between. I know there's some here who do. But one of the big differences is here in the when it comes time for the scrum, that great contest for the ball. In League, the rules kind of restrict things so that nothing much really happens. It's not really an event at all. But in Union, it's a different story. In Union, while at times it might look like in the scrum there's nothing happening, neither team is really moving, the truth is a different matter. In Union, in the middle of a scrum, both teams are fighting with all their might. These men are pushing with everything they've got, hoping how to just push back the opposing team just a little bit, just an inch or two. It might not look like they're moving, not doing anything, but the reality is they're putting everything they've got into it. That's exactly what the sailors are trying to do here in Jonah chapter 1. They're straining with all their might. They're hoping just to inch their way to the shore. But, of course, we know it's pointless. It's no ordinary storm they're fighting against. It's God himself that they're trying to overcome. We know it's God's grace that has raised this storm against them. God didn't send the storm because he wanted to sink the ship. He didn't send the storm to punish Jonah or to punish the sailors for helping him escape. No, it's because of God's grace that he sent the storm. You might think, how is getting caught in the middle of a big storm, how can that serve God's grace? Well, it's because of God's grace to the Ninevites. God wants to ensure that his prophet, his chosen messenger, doesn't get away. God wants to push him back onto the right path to deliver that message he has for the Ninevites. And in the end, the sailors realize that they're not getting anywhere. They see that they're the ones, in fact, who would need a bigger boat if they were going to overcome this storm. And so, at last, they pick up Jonah, and praying to God for forgiveness, they hurl him overboard. And straight away, the sea becomes calm. The waves are flat. The wind drops. Just like that, everything is still. And not surprisingly, the sailors respond in awe. We read back in verse 10 that when they heard what Jonah was doing, they feared the Lord. But now we read they feared with a great fear. And they put that fear into action. The passage tells us they not only fear God, but they begin worshipping him. They sacrifice sacrifices. They vow vows. They go over the top in their response to God's grace in delivering them from the storm. See, earlier on, Jonah had said he feared God, but he was running away from him. The sailors initially feared God, but they still tried to struggle against him. But it's only now, in experiencing God's grace in saving them, that they begin to worship him, not just in word, but in action. Meanwhile, Jonah, the prophet, well, he's still out there bobbing in the sea, and he's slowly sinking beneath the waves. The sea might be calm, but he's still stuck in it. Perhaps as he's floating around there, drifting away from the ship, maybe, just maybe, he realized that what he'd done was wrong and that he was getting his just deserts. But I suspect he was more likely thinking, well, at least I don't have to go to Nineveh. When, of course, out of nowhere, you've been waiting all this time, when here it comes, out of nowhere, up comes that big, famous fish, and gulp, swallows Jonah up. And there we go. And for the next 3 days and three nights, we read that Jonah lived inside the whale. To say thank you. This email came through from Rod last night, courtesy of Warwick. Warwick was sharing that on a family holiday 2 years ago, they made the exciting trip to the Whale Museum. Maybe not where I'd choose to go for my family holidays, but nonetheless, Warwick was there and he saw this sign and decided to take a photo. It's an account of a modern day Jonah, a whale fisherman back in 1891 who was swallowed up by a sperm whale and survived in its belly for 15 hours. He was only rescued after that time, but the story does go on to say he came out a different man. The whale's digestive juices had bleached his hair white, and for a month, well, for 2 weeks, he was delirious. He was blind, and it was about a month before he could share his story with anyone. Whether something like this happened to Jonah or not, we're not sure. But however it happened, that's not really what's important. Because no matter how big the fish might have been that swallowed Jonah, it pales in comparison to what we've already seen. I'm sorry to say, the fish is not the biggest part of the story of Jonah. I wonder, as we've been going along, if you spotted what's even bigger. What it is that's been lurking there just beneath the surface. I think by now I've probably actually gone over my script and mentioned it more than 20 times. Although you might have to check the audio to get an exact count. The thing that's bigger than the whale here is God's grace. His free, unmerited, unwanted favour. His incredible mercy and steadfast love. In the end, this big fish, no matter how big it was, is just an instrument of God's grace. God uses it to preserve the life of this reluctant, recalcitrant prophet. Even though Jonah had done everything he could to disobey God, even though Jonah had done everything he could to disobey God, God is still gracious towards him. And God is still being gracious towards the Ninevites, even though they'd sinned against him. In his grace, God desires to call them back, to warn them. And we see the great lengths he'll go, not just to show grace to Jonah, but also to the Ninevites. It's God's grace that is at the heart of Jonah chapter 1. And indeed, as we'll see in the coming weeks, it's God's grace that is at the heart of this whole book. So we've been on the road with Jonah. We've seen just the hints of some of these trails of grace. How enormous it is, stretching beyond all boundaries. How prevailing it is, continuing even when the prophet seeks to run all the way to the other ends of the earth. And how pervasive it is, extending not just to Israel, God's chosen people, but indeed to all people, even to the Ninevites, even the sailors, even to Jonah, even to us. And we've seen some of the hints of how we might respond to God's great grace. It's grace which is at the heart of this book. The famous theologian J.I. Packer once wrote that grace is the key to unlocking the New Testament. And he's certainly right about that, but he stopped a bit short, I think. As we've seen, grace is the key to understanding Jonah. Indeed, grace is the key to understanding the whole of the Old Testament and the New. Grace is at the heart of understanding our faith. For as Paul writes, it's by grace that we have been saved. It's God's grace that led him to offer up his son on the cross. It's by grace that Christ died there for us. It's by grace that Jesus, just as Jonah spent 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the fish, it's by grace that Jesus spent 3 days and 3 nights in the grave. It's by grace that God raised him up again to new life so that we too might have new life. God's grace, his unfailing kindness, his unmerited mercy, his steadfast love, even to those who've rebelled against him, even to Jonah, to the Ninevites, to the sailors, to us. Grace is at the key, is at the heart, not just of Jonah chapter 1 or the entire book, but the entirety of our faith. So as we set out as we embark on 2012, as we continue looking at this short little prophet, I pray that we will all be enriched and encouraged by reading about God's grace.